Michael. You want to start at the very beginning.
Yeah.
That's a very good place to start.
It's our anniversary, so I thought that'd be a good thing to do.
All right. Well, the only place to start from is with the Four Noble Truths. That comprises the entire teaching of the Buddha. I will say, though, that in the Dhammacakkappavatta Sutta, which is typically understood to be his very first sermon, he didn't start with the Four Noble Truths. He started with the middle path. And the middle path, or the middle way, is, let us say, someplace in the middle, the Goldilocks, the sweet spot, that is between two extremes. And whenever people practice anything to an extreme, they're definitely inviting dissatisfaction. In fact, they got to an extreme because they were already dissatisfied and arrived at the extreme thinking that this is the right place to be, but they're still dissatisfied. And that I see that on a regular basis. The most recent one is with Cathal has just ordained in the Wat at Udon Thani, and he was mentioning that the German monks there are really into getting it right, trying to find all the possible rules that ever were allowed and following them all. Quite an extreme. Now, there is some sort of an advantage to that, in the sense that if you can do all of that stuff, then you feel pretty proud of yourself. And that's exactly what the Buddha did, you know, that when he was on the trip, he had five guys with him, and they marveled at the fact that whatever any teacher had to do, he could do it better than the teacher. Even better than the dead teachers. And along that way, he got both thoroughly into the jhanas and thoroughly into the austerities, and he nearly killed himself with the austerities, going to an extreme. And so naturally, when he comes back to these five guys to start teaching them what he discovered while he was sitting doing nothing in Bodh Gaya, eating milk rice from a cowherd's daughter, I hear, getting fat.
Mm-hmm.
And they originally rejected him until he started teaching them the middle way, in the sense of this is where the extremes are. And that if we can understand this point, we can understand the real teachings of the Buddha, the deeper Dhamma. That going to an extreme is dukkha. And staying away from any extremes is better. An example of that would be having police that are like the Gestapo or like the American police versus having no police at all. And that the Thai police seem to have found that easy middle, where they don't go out and chase traffic, but they do go out when there is accidents. Otherwise, they stay in their station waiting for the phone to ring. Okay. That the cops in Thailand actually have to buy their own guns. If they want to have a gun, they got to buy it. To where in America, they give away all kinds of old military gear. Funny how we use the word SWAT to swat a fly.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the police call themselves SWAT, that means that everybody that they're around is a fly. And that's kind of an extreme. We can go through many, many extremes, but the whole idea is easy enough to understand, is that everything is easiest when we avoid all the extremes and come to an easy place in the middle. After the Buddha explains that, and by the way, in the first example that he gave was the difference between sensuality and austerities. And if you can think of it this way, that's the two extremes that he was practicing for those 6 years after he left home and became a wanderer. Now, it's easy enough to understand the austerity, self-flagellation, starving oneself to death, and following every possible rule that you can find. But the other extreme, most people think, is going to the brothel, getting drunk. Where, in fact, Buddha wasn't practicing that, and neither were any of the guys that he was talking to. So what was he talking to them about? Well, he was actually talking about the jhanas, are kind of an extreme. And yet the middle path winds up being the first jhana. That, in fact, you can think of the extremes this way, is that the self-flagellation is actually what we do when the mind is hindered, when it's got hindrances, when we flagellate ourselves not with ropes, but with thoughts. When we have negative thoughts, when we have judgments, when we have criticism, when we're critical of ourselves, when we're trying to find rules to follow, thinking that following a rule is going to be beneficial. And so then the other side of it would be going way far into the jhanas, to where the middle path is actually just the first jhana. Why? Because it is free from the hindrances, but it's also free enough from all of those things that people in the West desire and want. They don't even know what a fourth jhana is, but boy, they sure want one. And so in that regard, the middle path then can be understood that wanting things that we don't have, like mystical experiences and magical powers and all of that, is one extreme. And then fussing at ourselves and flagellating ourselves and criticizing ourselves is the other extreme. And the balance point is when we're free from dissatisfactions, when we're free from the hindrances, when we're free from unwholesome thoughts, and when we're just easy. You don't have to stop the mind, just point it in the right direction and keep pointing it in the right direction. So one extreme then would be the monkey mind that is just all over the place where most people are. And then there's all of these Dhamma dudes that want to stop the mind. Mm-hmm. That's another extreme. But the right place is just steady state, easy going, with no hindrances, no obstructions, no rules to follow. That, in fact, one of the ways that it looks like is that both of those extremes are not real. And in the regard of psychology, Eric Byrne had the teaching of the superego, the ego, and the id, which Eric Byrne translated as into parent, adult, and child. Well, that leaves us with the three positions of either having things the way that they should be, they're supposed to be, according to some standards or rules. And the other extreme is what we want. And the middle path is reality. The reality is that this is it, and yet we go around wanting things that we don't have and trying to get them by following some inappropriate rules or flagellating our mind with the mind, criticizing ourselves, telling ourselves we should be better. And then the child rebels against that and says, I don't want to be better. I want to be left alone. But that critical mind is not going to do that. So in there someplace, we have to change that critical mind into a nurturing mind, to where everything is okay because everything is real and reality is real. But there's one thing that's really important also about reality, and that is that real reality is only in this current moment. Real reality is not in the past. Mm-hmm. Real reality is not in the future. Reality is right now. And so we could also look at it in three ways, like parent, adult, and child. We can also look like it in the past, present, and future. To where the future is one extreme, the past is another extreme, and that mental path is right here, right now. And so this is really what the teachings of the Buddha are all about. And he talks about it in the sense of the Four Noble Truths. And there are many ways to talk about the Four Noble Truths, especially the first one, because that's the one that most people are so confused about and they miss it. They miss, in fact, their dissatisfaction. A really easy example to see is that in the Goenka system, when he says, when the mind wanders away from the breath, never mind, start again. But most people don't never mind and just start again. They take a few moments to fuss at themselves, to tell themselves, you're not up to the standard. You let that mind wander away.
I missed the never mind part.
And that's the never mind part, exactly, to never mind that you broke whatever rules that you're having, come back with nurturing and come back to the present moment. Never mind that we've gone into the past, never mind that we've gone into the future, come back now into the present moment. And this is where most of the dukkha, the dissatisfaction lies, is that we're not good enough now, and so we're setting standards for how things should be. Now, there's a lot of different ways. In fact, I think that it was you and I were talking about that the first noble truth could be that we don't like things. For instance, odors. Mm-hmm. We don't like odors. Things smell bad. Mm-hmm. Okay, and really that's because of our position. When we are too close to something or too far away from it, then there is going to be dukkha, there's going to be dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. If you're too far away, you can't see what it is, and when you're too close, you're not seeing it as it really is. Mm-hmm. That's in fact what physicists And particle physics has gotten it so wrong because they're looking too closely. Whatever it is, they want to tear it apart and look at what's left, and then tear that apart and see what's left. That in fact, 100 years ago, they thought that they had gotten it down to the unbreakable, the uncuttable. That means, in fact, in the Greek, atom. So when we have an atom, guess what? They find out that, in fact, a hydrogen atom can be broken up. A hydrogen atom is not an atom. Yet for some reason, 100 years later, we still call it an atom when we know for sure it's not. Mm-hmm. But then what is an electron? Well, those things are hard to get a hold of because they're nothing but just movement, spinning. And what gives the mass to the hydrogen is in the nucleus, But the nucleus can be broken down into quarks and up and down and back and forth, I suppose, also. And there's just no end to how deep they will go into it. And then the other extreme of physics is Hubble's and James Webb and looking at really, really big things. And then they're trying to put the two together. How can particle physics and astrophysics merge? And they don't. And so you have all of these physicists unhappy to where if we live in the reality, then we're living in sort of the middle path, somewhere about human size. And that's where things actually is the sweet spot. However, us humans have been told from childhood that we're not good enough, that we have to improve. And so most people spend the rest of their lives trying to get better at something or another, thinking that if they get things better, they'll be happy. And the reality is that that's actually practicing being unhappy. Going from one unhappiness to the next unhappiness, step by step, inch by inch, we're progressing. But we're always unhappy with where we are, and we have to continue to progress. When are we ever going to arrive? Actually, arrival is a mental state. And we have to practice arriving. The Buddha talked about it in the sense of the job that needed to be done has been done. And what is the job that needs to be due? It needs to stop trying to get something. The job is not to get something. The job is to stop trying to get something. That the easiest way to end a to-do list is not going through that to-do list item after item, fixing every problem. The easy way to get through a to-do list is crumple it up and throw it out. And then we got nothing to do. The job's been done.
That's a good point.
So this is really the foundation of what the Buddha teaches, is to recognize that our dissatisfactions we are trying to fix. And yet one of the most important qualities of the state of dukkha is wanting something you don't have. That's the dukkha. And what we need to practice is not wanting to have things that we don't have and be satisfied with the things that we do have. Wanting something that we don't have is actually an unwholesome thought. And being satisfied with what we do have right here, right now, that's wholesome. Wholesome enough. And we become satisfied. Now, in that regard, the Buddha talks about the Eightfold Noble Path in the beginning to really fully understand what is right noble view. And he decides what is wrong view and what is ordinary right view. And basically, ordinary right view is setting all those rules, all those standards, all of that sila, all of that morality. And wrong view is that I can go do anything that I want to do and get it and get away with it. Now, the funny thing is that in politics, that begins to look like that the conservatives have the right noble view, the right ordinary view, and the progressives have the wrong view. Why is that? Because the progressives say, oh, we can go build a society. We can put in infrastructure. We can do this. We can do that. And we don't have to pay for it. Or somehow it'll get paid for. Maybe we can tax the rich. Ask the rich if they want that. And so what you wind up with is a war between ordinary right view and wrong view. which back to the point of the parent and the child, those are those two positions. And what noble right view is actually looking at things in reality, seeing things the way that they really are. And so these three issues that all run a circle around the middle path, this extreme, that extreme, and the middle path, wrong view, ordinary right view, and the noble middle path. The parent on one side, the child on the other side, and in reality is the adult. And also past and future, and in the middle is right now. So this might be a way of understanding how to get started.
Yeah, I think that's the whole thing.
Yeah, right. That's the whole point is, can we, in fact, stop wanting things to be different in the future and stop remorsing over the past and just be happy with the way things are right now? That's the whole point. So this is where right noble view comes in. The right noble view needs an assistant. In fact, it needs two assistants. It needs two helpers. One is to remember to look, to remember to come back to reality and take a look. And then the second helper is right noble effort to make a change, to come out of the past and the future and come into the here now. To come out of one extreme or the other and come to the middle place. That's what takes the right effort. But we have to be able to see what is the middle place. And we have to remember, continuously remember, to keep looking to find that middle ground, to find that middle place. Now, a really clear example of that is where you are right now is in a room where the reality is that you're safe. And yet, if you think about all the dangerous things that have happened to you, you can feel fear. And if you think about all the things that could go wrong, then you'll have fear. But the reality is, right now, you're safe. And so what we actually practice then is coming to that state of being safe and secure and comfortable right now as the prerequisites, because if there is any fear, in fact, you could say that all emotions are based upon whether or not there is fear involved. For instance, you've heard of anxiety, stress, anger, frustration, guilt, shame, grief, sadness. All of those things have an element in the base of it, of fear. And when there is no fear, then you have a whole other list of feelings or emotions, like elated, happy, joyful, satisfied, on top of the world, feeling like a winner. And on that other side is basically the attitude of a loser. The loser is the one who is afraid, and the top dog is the one who is not afraid because he's got his life under control. And so this is the two extremes that we can begin to see, that the basis of it is fear, and that if we can come to a middle ground, a middle place, to where everything is satisfactory, everything is joyful, then we can have a happy life. But we have to practice that. Why do we have to keep practicing? Is because look how many years of practice that you and everybody that you know are as well skilled at being unhappy. It's quite a skill to be in it. No matter how wonderful things are, you're still unhappy. You want things to be better.
Actually, earlier, like maybe 10 minutes ago, when you said we miss the dukkha, you were saying like we don't see it But what I heard was we miss it, you know, like we like a person you love being gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because our identity is based off of our dukkha.
Mm-hmm. You know, here's something that's very interesting. In the English language, when the wife comes home, either she or he will say, "I missed you." In the Thai language, they don't say that. What they say, the Thai language says, "Kit Tung Kun." And what that translates to is, "I was thinking about you." Now, that's kind of neutral, because "I was thinking about you" means that I'm not involved with missing you, feeling fearful, feeling like I might not see you again, but just thinking about her. And so that's a kind of a way that we can see that, in fact, our language, the way that we're taught language, the language itself creates the dukkha. A clear example of that is, I'm afraid, I'm anxious, I'm frustrated. Well, guess what? Anger and frustration are not your nature, so why are we claiming that that's our nature? I am is nature.
Mm-hmm.
And yet anger comes and goes. And we don't say, right now I'm experiencing anger. We don't say, right now I feel frustrated. In fact, there is frustration, not I feel frustrated, but there is frustration, there is anger, is real, but I'm frustrated, I'm angry, that's not real. And it has the two elements of, one, thou shalt not be angry and frustrated, and number two, I don't like being angry and frustrated, but the reality is, there is anger, and there is frustration. But we don't like it because of the two things, mostly concerned with the rules. You're not supposed to be angry. And so people will deny it. In fact, the joke is that there's a bar fight. These guys are about to go to blows. They're really hot. Maybe it's because one of them is from Manchester and he walks into a Liverpool bar and they start talking about football. And the next thing you know, fists are up, right? And somebody says, "You guys calm down, you're too angry." And both of them will say, "I'm not angry." When in fact, it's clear to everybody in the room that they are, but it's not clear to them. Because why? Because the reality is that they're not supposed to be angry, and therefore, they're not angry. Even though the reality is that there is anger there.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is where we're going now, is to begin to understand that we can start looking at the way things actually are without judging it, without finding a problem with it. That in fact, Adam and Eve, as the story goes, lived in a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of the Christians and all of them people who read the Bible thinking that the Bible is real actually miss the point of the story. They get all up into talking snakes and the girl did it and apples and fig leaves and getting kicked out of the Garden of Eden. The reality is that if you read it carefully, you can see that they ate of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. And what does that mean? It means that they have to put up with their judgments, their knowledge of good and evil. And because we call the paradise good on that side and evil over there, we wind up destroying the paradise, which is just a real place. Reality is real. It's a paradise. But we destroy our reality by judging it, wanting it to improve, wanting it to get better. And so whenever you become discomfortable, Whenever you want something to be changed, that's the time to wake up. That's the time to recognize, hey, wait a minute, things are already good enough. We already live in a paradise, and the destruction of the paradise is because of our judgments, our wanting it to be different, our set of standards, our rules. And so if I yell in anger, so what? I can get over it. I don't stew over it. As soon as I see the anger, it's gone. But if I'm not supposed to be angry, then I'll deny my anger, and then I'll keep my anger because I can't see it because I'm denying it.
Especially if you think that you've crossed like some checkpoint, you know, where no anger or...
Rule, we've got a standard. Thou shalt not be angry. You're a Buddhist dude now, you can't be angry. That's not what the Buddha teaches. He doesn't teach thou shalt not be angry. He teaches, look at what you're doing. Is that the way you want to feel? Can you see the fear under it? Do you recognize the reality is that things are not dangerous right now? Why should I feel fear and then add anger on top of it? But it really is not my business. So whenever the wife wants something, you just let her have it. Let her have her way. That in fact, there is a sutta. It's number 31 in the Dinga Nikaya. It's just a little passage. It's almost easy to miss. But in there, the Buddha is giving advice, five lessons of advice to laymen. And I've forgotten four, but boy, do I remember that one. And what is that one? Is let the wife do what she wants to do. And yet husbands think that they're going to be the spiritual leader. They're the boss. They've got responsibilities. They've got to lead the household and all of that kind of stuff. Islam is really bad about it, but Christians are pretty nasty also. And the reality is, as the Buddha says, is that if you're going to be a Dhamma dude, then just hang out and let the women do what they want to do. Because if you don't, you're going to have trouble. But in fact, one of our family jokes is that I keep calling Tam the boss. She's the boss. Mm-hmm. If you call the wife the boss, she don't want to be the boss when you call her that. But when you don't call her that, she wants to be the boss. And so if you contradict her, you're going to have trouble. And so this is the time to practice the Dhamma, is when you need it the most. And for the very, very beginner, which I assume that you're not, the very, very, very beginner has to get off into seclusion to see that actually what he's got going is he's got a mommy inside his own mind that he is fighting against, the rules. The mommy who keeps telling you what to do. The mommy, go ahead.
I was just thinking like, I don't know, I have the people in my life are different. Like my wife is different than what you're talking about. And my relationship with my mom is different, but what I was thinking is that I've been having the same realization several times a year since I was 15 years old. So it's been about 22 years. And like, what my mind does is it creates concepts to try to solve. And then it gets bored with them, and then it realizes what we're talking about here, and then it creates a new concept, and then I go chasing after that concept, and I'm just like, it's amazing how long I've been doing that to myself, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can imagine back in the old, old days, way back when, in the time of the Buddha, that he had two different kinds of students. Mm-hmm. He had bhikkhus. And basically who the bhikkhus were the unlanded. Those who owned no land, which meant they owned no responsibilities. And it was easy enough for them just to leave home, take up the robe and bowl, and enjoy their life. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of the followers of the Buddha were actually landowners. They were from his caste. They were from the warrior class, the aristocracy, the merchant class, the ones who had land. And what he would teach them was to find your porch, sit down, and just enjoy the paradise. If you've got employees, if you've got a farm to run, if you stop all of that and become a bhikkhu, look how many people you hurt. Mm-hmm. But the right way to do it is just let the farm run by itself, especially let the wife run the farm, because she's trying to run it anyway. And the plantation owner has really now nothing to do. He just sits down and enjoys life. All right. So you've gotten yourself into a situation to where you think that you still got to run the farm. You've gotten all of these bills to pay. You've got all of these expenses. You've got all of these employees who are wanting their cut, bankers and whatnot. Power companies, all of these people that you employ, and now you got to pay them. And so the better thing to do is to recognize that maybe you don't need so much. If you can find a way of not having such big bills to pay and so many mouths to feed, then you can take it easy. And here you are working, what, two jobs now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But in a way, this is just time structure, because number one job is that you're teaching high school. Mm-hmm. And if you expect that you can educate a teenager, you're really deluded. So what you can do in high school instead is just have fun with them.
I think that's what I mostly do these days.
And then as a barkeep, you don't have to sell alcohol. All you have to do is just be friends with the barflies. So you can learn to sit on that porch and do nothing, whether the porch is at school or whether the porch is behind the bar. It's just to sit down and do nothing and enjoy your life. If you can remember that.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that more of my dukkha comes from my intellectual proliferation about concepts that at the moment
how things should be
have no appeal. Like right now, like I'm having trouble coming up with things to say because my mind is very still. But which, you know, happened a year ago after I talked to you and you pointed out some of the chasing, going into the future, going into the past, conceptualizing Nibbana, things like that. And I think there was probably like a straight month where like everything was peachy, you know? But then, you know, my mind went back to its habit of like, oh, well, what about what it says in this sutta, or what about this idea, or what about this guy? And, you know,
Making the sutras your enemy because you're trying to make them a rule.
Yeah, and just, you know, I went in like a bunch of circles again, came back to the same place, you know. But, you know, I think the reason I messaged you earlier that I wanted to call you today is because I was noticing in my mind, I was like noticing that it's ready to give that up. I was like, okay, I'm going to call Damarado. and I'm going to break this habit once and for all. I don't even remember when we first talked. I told you.
You're not going to do that. You'll keep coming back over and over again. Be mindful. Watch what's going on. You're like the farmer who says that that I've got a whole field full of cows, but none of them shit. There are no cow pies out there. The guy who thinks there are no cow pies is going to wind up being covered with cow pies. You have to recognize that there are cow pies out there. Watch your step. Then you can avoid them.
Yeah, I guess the one thing that I feel that I'm definitely done with, hopefully, is like trying to come up with a metaphysical understanding, you know, like trying to come up with some kind of metaphysical conclusion. That I feel that I've definitely grown tired of that.
Metaphysical conclusion, does that mean you're looking for the meaning of life? What's it all about, Alfie?
Not necessarily. Like
power?
Like
alchemy?
I guess metaphysics is like what truly exists beyond the illusion of perception or whatever. I don't know how to explain it right now, but
isn't that interesting that real physics, particle physics and astronomical physics is still a kind of a metaphysics because there's no end to it.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't the physicists just come to the position that, yeah, we don't understand all of that stuff, but it's not important. The mm-hmm. world's not going to fall apart because they don't know what a quasar is. They don't have to know. We already know enough.
They know that they're full of quasars. That's all they know.
I just read an article today or yesterday that now they have cataloged 1.3 million black holes. And 100 years ago, they were still concerned with whether they existed or not. Now, I ask you, a physicist 100 years ago was confused and doubtful about the black holes, if they existed or not. And the modern physicists are concerned and worried, do they've got them all? What's changed?
Nothing.
Nothing's changed. They're still unhappy because they still want something.
Yeah, maybe that's why the Buddha, you know, when he spoke about the universe externally, he basically said it's, you know, beginningless. He was just like, let's just put that question aside.
Yeah, who knows? Who cares? We don't know how it began. I don't care. What I care about is not the deep, dark past or the big, dark future. Can we see mm-hmm. what's happening right here, right now? That's the middle place. Always coming back to the middle path. Can you take it easy? The way things really are. Which is also the middle path between I like it and I don't like it. I like it and I don't like it. Those are the two extremes.
One thing that I was noticing about this whole addiction to thinking that I have is basically what I'm thinking, talking about is that they have an addiction to thinking. Is that at this point, you know, in practice, if I just sit in my car for a few minutes, like my mind becomes still. And when my thinking stills, my sense of being kind of vanishes. I really base my sense of being is really tied up in thinking. And so there's like this internal like restlessness that doesn't want to allow thinking to cease because there's like an attachment and also there's like a fear connected to it because, you know, I'm a teacher and my whole life I've like used thinking and speaking of ways of like, just that's kind of like one of my main assets. So I feel like there's like a fear that if I allow my mind to like to settle into the stillness like it's capable of, that like somehow I'm not going to have access to all of that thinking that I usually do, that I turn into speaking, that has done so much for me in the mundane sense. So that's something I've noticed in my mind, that like there's an attachment and a fear to allow that is not allowing the mind to like settle.
Well, the first place to go, always the first place to go in that settled mind is that it's settled in the sense of being satisfied. That we don't have to stop the mind. We could just direct it towards satisfaction. That where we are is good enough. Because the mind, in fact, is actually not geared for, or let us say instinctual or DNA-wise, the mind is built to be constantly in motion, just like the heart, right? All night long, the heart beats. You don't have to be running a race. The heart's still thump, ka-thump, ka-thump. Breathing is like that. We don't stop breathing because we're relaxed. So don't expect the mind to stop any more than you would expect to stop breathing. And in fact, that's one of the things that some of the kids play with, is trying to stop their breathing. And some of those kids are, you know, pretending that that's jhana.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let's not try to stop the mind, because if you say, you can talk to Damarato and you can talk about sitting in the car and stopping the mind, but then the thought will come, well, right now it won't stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then you become dissatisfied. Can you actually see that sometimes you thought the mind was stopped, but in fact, the realization that it hasn't stopped is the only thing that it's doing.
Yeah, I guess you can say it's more so like slowed down to a reasonable pace.
Mm-hmm. Right, down to a middle path.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of running rampant or stopped altogether, just nice and easy. That's the middle way. So don't take it to the extreme, because that's where the rules are. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to take things, get better and better and better at it. No, this is good enough.
Well, it's definitely what you're talking about, being satisfied, because the way that dissatisfaction takes, the form dissatisfaction takes with me is questions. I just endlessly come up with new questions. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, come up with a million answers to them. And so when the mind is satisfied, there's no questions being produced. And then, I mean, that's the main thing. Yeah. I mean, I don't have like questions in the mind. Like right now, I'm having trouble coming up with things to say, because I don't really have any questions in the mind at the moment.
Michael has just arrived. Michael, come say hi to Michael.
Hey, Michael, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. How's Copen gone?
He's asking you, how is Copen gone?
Excellent.
Pa-nang. It's not Copen gone, it's Ko-pa-nang. Ko-pa-nang.
It's been almost 12 years since I've been in Thailand. I can't remember how to say anything.
Oh, that's all right. That's how the Westerners pronounce it. They see it written down and they always divide it between the N and the G, to where actually it's divided. The pa nang is the way that it's said.
The way I picked up Thai while I was there was treating it almost like karaoke, because they have like that specific tone that they use, like the intonation, and they're like, and unless I was mimicking other Thai people, I couldn't get words right. So, but anyway.
All right. Well, let's kind of leave it here. This is a good place to stop because there's no place to go.
Exactly.
To have the mind to come to a rest, but you don't have to stop it. Mm-hmm. That in fact, even when a ship is in port, it's still moving. That's why they tie it up with ropes and put boundaries in there with the balloons and the tires and all of that, because that ship's going to continue moving. It's in the water. So see, the mind is also like that. That don't try to tie it up rigidly. Don't try to stop it. Just dock it.
Dock it, yeah. I mean, I think the fact that you focus on being satisfied and staying satisfied, it almost, you know, skips ahead to that ninth fetter, you know? It's like getting right to quenching that restlessness. And every time I'm proliferating about some question in the mind, there's a little voice in my head that says, like, the only reason you're asking this question is because you're not satisfied.
Mm-hmm. Well, the funny thing about the word satisfied is that it's exactly opposite of being dissatisfied. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a Buddha could say in English language, I only teach one thing, dissatisfaction and satisfaction. I like the phrase, don't worry, be happy. That restless mind is the worry. Mm-hmm. Trying to fix something that's not broken.
Yeah, or trying to break things so that you can fix them.
Right, breaking stuff so you can fix it, exactly.
Yep. All right, well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Great.
Great as always.
We'll see you later. Join us on our calls. It's good when you're on.
Yeah, thank you. They're usually during like bath time or bedtime with the kids. But anyway, I'll pop in as often as I can.
Good. We'll see you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.